breathe in
the fires in the Yukon.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Similar.
When you speak of climate change, assuming most people that are listening would immediately think, well, the Kyoto Treaty. I've heard you and the ICC speak of it in the past. Do you believe the Kyoto Treaty would go far enough in theory if it were implemented to making the kinds of changes that are going to be needed to basically, quote unquote, save the Arctic?
No, it will not. The Kyoto, of course, is commitments from 2008 to 2012. It's a first step, and if they are brought about, it's an important treaty. It is not enough, however. Under the scenarios that are being put forward now, even a 2 degree centigrade level of global warming, which is what the European Union seems to think is a sufficient target to meet, that means at least a doubling or a tripling in the Arctic because of just the physical conditions of where the Arctic is. It means a doubling or tripling of those temperatures. And under those, that doubling or tripling of the 2 degrees, you're looking at a full unfolding of the projections in the Arctic climate impact assessment. So disappearance of summer sea ice, certain species pushed to extinction, Inuit culture as well pushed to extinction, I may say.
When I've heard recently talk about this in the South, I've been startled that there does seem to be kind of a disconnect. Has that been your experience? How has the response to the plight of the Arctic North been in your recent trips or communications with the South?
Well, I guess it depends on what level. I think weather events and more extreme weather events, which are coming about because of climate change, are starting to hit everywhere, and including in less vulnerable areas such as southern Canada and the United States. And I think with those more frequent weather events, extreme weather events, people are starting to understand that climate change is a real, it's a human issue. It's not some environmental issue that will not affect them. Everyone will be affected at some point. It may be happening first here. It may be happening hardest. However, what you're seeing here will soon be happening to you in other areas.
I've heard it referred to as the Arctic as the bellwether of the health of the planet. Would you agree to that?
Yes, and really what we're saying is this is something that we have to learn from, something we have to take advantage of. We should not ignore this. What we see happening in the Arctic should inform our decision-making for the good of the whole planet, and Inuit really see it that way. Recently, we were at a UN conference, and we met with a number of countries that are also very vulnerable, low-lying states such as Tuvalu and Kiribati in the Pacific, folks from Bangladesh. And because as the Arctic melts, and the Greenland ice cap in particular melts, sea level rises, and these countries flood, they now realize that the projections that have been made for the Arctic have profound implications for their own survival. So there's huge implications and very important connections with small island states, with low-lying states. And in Bangladesh alone, you're looking at over 120 million people that will be affected by sea level rise over the next centuries. These 120 million people will have to go somewhere, and already we're dealing with a region that's very unstable. The Arctic has profound implications and connections to all of that.
It's the first of the dominoes.
It's one of the first of the dominoes. There's other very affected regions, vulnerable regions. Any country that is dependent on glacial melt and on a steady, on glaciers for their water, with glaciers disappearing. So countries such as Nepal, Bhutan, certain parts of China, if glaciers disappear, you're looking at huge impacts on agriculture because of changes in water flows, very dangerous impacts in terms of glacial lakes forming and then bursting and wiping out, whole watersheds. As well, these are often countries that are dependent on flows of water to produce electricity. Well, that will be changing substantially. And while I point out some of these countries that are more vulnerable, such as Nepal, there are many others along the Andes, Peru, Chile, Argentina, that are very dependent, among others, on flows from the Andean glaciers, and also in places such as California. And there's a recent assessment of the impacts of climate change on California, and that points to some profound changes in water rights and the water flow in California. And of course, the population of California is huge. So we're finding that people are seeing these connections more and more, but the United States more and more. Including nations who've come to states, nations who've come to miss it.
It's similar.
But when
to
they
the,
do think about it, they do see the connections.
Yeah, it's very similar to the boiled frog theory. A frog will die in a pot of boiling water because it doesn't notice it. Yes, because it happens gradually. On that same note, a moment ago, you mentioned the UN and countries getting together there. More recent times, there's been the start of the International Criminal Court, or the World Criminal Court. Some people have wanted to see previous dictatorial leaders, such as Augusto Pinochet and others, even people like George Bush, tried for various war crimes. Do you think politicians who deliberately allow global warming should be brought up on charges in an international body for not taking the plight of both their citizens and others seriously?
Well, I think we're taking a step in that direction, not so much taking an individual, but by bringing a complaint against a particular country and by saying that environmental security is a basic human right. So whereas I wouldn't be able to comment on taking someone to the International Criminal Court for such a thing, I believe it is a step in the right direction to bring this into the human rights institutions, international human rights institutions that exist, because really climate change is a human issue. Right. It is not a removed environmental issue. It is a human issue that lends itself to being discussed in a human rights forum.
As recent exercises called Exercise Narwhal, moving troops into the areas of the north to practice military exercises in what were the largest such exercises in the north, in Canadian military history. They stated reasons for doing that were to be able to protect a Northwest Passage. So it seems to me that the governments in Ottawa are part and parcel of promoting the idea that climate change can have a useful aspect as opposed to working very hard to try to change it. Along with that militarization, there have been also recent hints from the outgoing U.S. ambassador to Canada that Canada has already agreed to become a part of the proposed ballistic missile defense programs with bases in Greenland as well as Alaska and perhaps in parts of the Inuit North. What would be the impact on people who live in this so-called Canadian territory? The Inuit Circumpolar Conference is in opposition to the ballistic missile defense programs.
Yeah, now the position of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference has been in the past to decry militarization of the north, of the Arctic. Currently, in terms of ballistic missile defense, we don't have sufficient information to really comment on it. And that's, at this point, is a huge problem because we're not, and I think this is not just a problem for Inuit, is that there's just not sufficient information to understand what is being involved and how it will impact on the Arctic. How will it impact on Inuit? I think as a general stance, Inuit are very reluctant to see the North militarized further because there's been very big impacts of militarization in the past, including environmental impacts.
Can you speak
about
those?
So at this point, I can in particular say in Canada, there was the Dewline Defense Early Warning Site, and they are strewn across the Arctic and sometimes the subarctic. In the Arctic, they were put in during the Cold War, and most of them have been decommissioned. Well, that decommissioning has been very expensive and involved large amounts of cleanup because those sites are contaminated sites and they are huge point sources of contaminants such as furans, dioxins, PCBs, and among others. So there's been those types of impacts are something that has predisposed the Inuit to be somewhat suspicious of further militarization.
If people wanted to get in contact with the ICC or learn more, how can they do that?
The best thing to do would be to go through our website, and ICC Canada and the other organizations all are on the World Wide Web, and that's probably the best portal into our world, and then you can contact us through there.
The website for the Inuit Circumpolar Conference is available at InuitCircumpolar.com, where you can click on one of the four countries that Inuit reside in and you wish to learn more about, or you can also access more from Inuit.org. I would like to once again thank Paul Crowley of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and Wesley Hardesty of the Arctic Indigenous Youth Alliance for giving us all a chance to hear more directly from the people of the North about the challenges they face in the upcoming years. Again, the website of the AIYA, Arctic Indigenous Youth Alliance, is denayyouthalliance.ca, and the Inuit Circumpolar Conference can be reached at inuitcircumpolar.com. This has been recorded for Native Solidarity News, which is hosted at CKUT Radio in Montreal. CKUT.ca is the website.